A New Life. That was how Casper and I came to America, as stowaways, as survivors from the Titanic. When we docked in New York, we came down the gangplank of the Carpathia together, the Stanton family and Casper and me. Mr. Stanton said a discussion was called for with the immigration authorities, and as a consequence of this, I was allowed to go and stay with them in their house in Greenwich Village. From the very start, I was treated as if I was one of them. I was told I should never call them again Mr. and Mrs. Stanton. No more sir or madam. It would be Robert and Anne from now on. I found this very difficult at first. Old habits die hard, but it became ever more natural as the weeks passed. But then Elizabeth fell sick, very sick. The terrible cold of that night on the ocean had reached her lungs, and she had caught pneumonia. The doctor came often to begin with, a taciturn man who did little to relieve our anxiety. Casper stayed with her all through her illness, scarcely ever leaving her bed. All the rest of us would take it in turns to sit with her. Then one morning I came in and she was sitting up in bed with Casper on her lap and smiling at me. She was her sunny self again, but for some time afterwards she still had to stay in her room and rest, which she didn't care for at all, not one bit. Elizabeth claimed that it had to be Casper who had brought luck to all of us. Because of Casper, she said, they had survived the night in the boat, and because of Casper, she had recovered from her pneumonia. I had a big argument with her about that. Much as I loved Casper, I never much believed in superstitions. You might as well say, I told her, that it was Casper who brought us bad luck in the first place. The worst luck, that maybe it was because Casper was on board that the Titanic had sunk in the first place. Nonsense, Elizabeth retorted. It was an iceberg, not Casper, that sank the Titanic. I think I discovered then, if I hadn't before, that I could never have an argument with Elizabeth and expect to win. That one way or another, she would always have the last word. During Elizabeth's convalescence, when she still wasn't allowed out of the house, I got to know Robert and Anne a great deal better. It took a while for me to feel completely at ease with them when we were alone, and I think they sensed it. They took it upon themselves to give me a good time, to show me New York. We went up the Empire State Building, visited the Statue of Liberty and the zoo, all of which made Elizabeth very jealous. And once we went collecting horseshoe crab shells on a beach on Long Island. Best of all, I learned to ride with Anne in Central Park. She took me riding almost every day. I hadn't been on a horse before, so I had a lot to learn. But Anne was full of encouragement. "You ride so well, Johnny," she told me once, "as if you'd been born in the saddle. I'm very proud of you." The truth is that I loved being with them, whatever we were doing. I felt as if I was a son for the first time. Having a mother and father of my own was better than I'd ever imagined it could be. I was having the time of my life. In the evenings, I'd be up in Elizabeth's room playing with Casper if he was awake and learning how to play chess with Elizabeth when he wasn't. I liked chess, although I never managed to win a single game against her. As for Casper, he had the run of the place as I did, and very soon had occupied the piano in the drawing room and made it his own. Everyone in the house, Elizabeth's governess, the servants too, all simply adored him. Like me, he couldn't have been happier. Only one cloud hung over me, the knowledge that sooner or later all these golden days would have to end and I'd have to leave. How I dreaded that day. One evening, some months afterwards, I was called down into the drawing room to find the family all lined up in front of the fireplace. Elizabeth was in her dressing gown. Casper was sitting on the piano watching me, his tail swishing. Elizabeth was looking at me conspiratorily. Clearly, she knew something I didn't. Her mother and father, on the other hand, were looking very serious and stiff, rather as they had been when I'd first seen them that time back in their rooms at the Savoy Hotel. This is it, I thought. This is when they tell me my time's up, that I have to go back to London to my job as a bellboy in the Savoy. Robert cleared his throat. He was going to make some kind of speech. I prepared myself for the worst. "Johnny, the three of us have come to a decision," he began. "You know how much we have enjoyed having you with us here as our guest. Elizabeth has told us of your circumstances back home in England, that you have no family as such to go back to." He hesitated, and that was when Anne spoke up. I guess what we're trying to say, Johnny, is that after all that has happened, and knowing you now as well as we do, and what a fine young man you are, we would very much like you to consider not returning to London, but instead staying here and making your home with us in New York. We'd be really proud to have you here, as one of the family, if you'd like, that is. What do you say? I remember Casper and Elizabeth both looking up at me, waiting for me to say something. It took me a while not to make up my mind. I did that instantly, but to get over my surprise and find my voice. "Oh, come on, Johnny Trot, say yes, please," Elizabeth cried. "Okay," I replied. It was a new expression I'd picked up in New York. I was so overwhelmed that it was all I could bring myself to say. But it was enough. Everyone hugged me then, and we all cried a little, except Casper, who had sprung up on the piano and was busy washing himself. So by the gracious of good fortune, I acquired a new life, a new home, and a new country. They sent me back to school, which at first I didn't care for. I thought I'd finished all of that. I'd never been much good at books and reading all that. But Robert read stories to us all in the evenings, and through him I came to like books a lot better than I had. Gradually, school became much easier, and sometimes even enjoyable. They teased me a bit at first on account of my London Cockney accent, and so to start with felt a bit alone. But someone put it about that I was a survivor from the Titanic, and after that I had all the friends I could handle. We spent long summers in Maine, sailing up there on the Abe Lincoln. Elizabeth and I went walking in the woods and fishing, and everywhere we went, Casper came with us. They were great days, days I shall remember all my life. I was to have gone off to college to William and Mary in Virginia, where Robert himself had once been a student. I never got there. In Europe, the First World War was raging, and my old country was fighting for her life. So when in 1917 America sent troops over to fight in France, I went with them. And who did I find marching alongside me up the front? Little Mitch! We just picked up where we'd left off all those years before on the Titanic, on the Carpathia, and were best friends from then on. While I was at the front, I'd get letters every week from Elizabeth, who was away at boarding school by now. I'd look forward to every one of them, because I could hear her voice in her writing, see her face as I was reading her words, and that cheered me more than I can say. When all around me in France I saw nothing but horror and death. And with her letters, Elizabeth would sometimes send me little sketches, and once a beautiful drawing of Casper sitting there looking at me, willing me to come home, it seemed. I kept it with me in my tunic pocket, along with a photograph of her and me by the seashore in Maine. Elizabeth always said afterwards, when the war was over, that it must have been the drawing of Casper that had kept me safe and brought me home. I'm not sure she was right about that, but she insisted on having it framed and put up in pride of place in the front hall. When no one's looking, I do reach out and touch it sometimes, so I suppose that I must be just a little bit superstitious, but I'm not admitting that to her. Right after the war, Mitch came to work with me in Robert's publishing business. He had become quite a family friend by now. We worked together in the packing room in the basement. Robert said we had to learn the business from the bottom upwards, so we did, literally. For me, books became part of my life. I didn't just pack them, I read them voraciously, and very soon began to write stories of my own. And while I was writing, Elizabeth could be up in her attic studio, drawing or painting or sculpting animals mostly. On our holidays in Maine, we wouldn't climb trees anymore or go diving off the quay. She'd sit on the rocks by the seashore with her sketchbook out, and I'd scribble away nearby, and Casper would wander between us to remind us he was there. We would often talk of the old days in London, of Mr. Freddy and Skullface and the Great Roof Rescue, and more than once she said what fun it would be to go back to visit, but I didn't think she was serious. Then just before her 17th birthday, she announced to us that she was too old now to be given birthday presents. Instead, she was going to give us something, providing, she added, that we didn't mind giving it away. None of us knew quite what to make of this until she took us out into the front hall, and there it was, sitting on the table below the famous sketch she had sent out to me in France during the war, was a magnificent sculpture of Casper. His neck arched, his tail curled around him. "I carved it out of ashwood," she said, "and then I painted it jet black. And you know what I want. I want to take it back to London and give it to the hotel where we stayed, where I first saw Casper and Johnny. I want it to be there forever. It's where Casper belongs. Casper could come too. He may be old, but he's fit as a fiddle." "Well," she said, beaming brightly at us, "when do we go?" We went 6 months later, and little Mitch came with us too. We wanted him to come, to show him where it all happened, where the whole story had begun, a story he was part of, that had changed all our lives forever. I won't pretend that any of us much enjoyed the crossing of the Atlantic. There were too many terrible memories, but we kept them to ourselves and never once mentioned the Titanic. In fact, we had hardly ever mentioned the Titanic in all these years. It was what bound us inseparably and what distanced us from others who had not been there, but we had rarely spoken of it among ourselves. All together again on the wide Atlantic, we faced our fears and took strength from one another's silence. Mr. Freddy was there to greet us at the front door of the Savoy, and when we went inside, the staff were waiting to welcome us. Casper yelled from his basket as they all clapped us in, so I took him out to show everyone. He loved all the attention, and to tell the truth, so did I. Mary O'Connell was still there, head housekeeper now, instead of Skullface. She gave Anne a huge bunch of red roses and cried on my shoulder as she hugged me. As for the bellboy who took us up in the lift, he was a Cockney lad, just like me, wearing the same uniform, with his cap worn at the same jaunty angle. He showed us into the Countess Kandinsky's old rooms, with windows looking out over the Thames down towards the Houses of Parliament. Casper made himself at home at once, resuming his place on the piano and proceeding to washing himself vigorously. He was as happy as I'd ever seen him. He slept on the window ledge in the sun all the rest of that day. He'd been doing a lot of sleeping lately. We had an unveiling ceremony outside the American Bar the next morning, and much to Elizabeth's delight, everyone seemed to like the sculpture as much as they loved Casper himself. He was there at the ceremony, but wandered off during the speeches. I watched him go, waving his tail as he went. It was the last I ever saw of him. He just disappeared. Everyone searched the hotel over and over again. From the basement to the attic corridor, he was nowhere to be found. It's well enough known that old cats go off to die when they're good and ready, I think, and Elizabeth thinks that's what he must have done. We were sad, of course we were. He was a cat that had brought us together, had survived with us, and he was gone. But in a way, as I told Elizabeth, trying to comfort her, he is not gone. He's sitting there proudly outside the American Bar. You can go and see him for yourself if you like. He's still there, looking very pleased with himself, and so he should be. After all, he is Prince Casper Kandinsky, Prince of Cats, a Muscovite, a Londoner, and a New Yorker, and as far as anyone knows, the only cat to survive the sinking of the Titanic. And then, only a year or so after our visit to London, we received a letter from Mr. Freddy. "Dear Johnny and Elizabeth, I'm writing to tell you of a strange happening. Several guests at the hotel have reported sighting a black cat wandering the corridors late at night. I took no notice at first, but it has happened time and time again, and I thought you ought to know. And just yesterday, a lady staying in your room, the Countess Kandinsky's room, reported seeing a reflection in the mirror of a grand lady in an ostrich-feathered hat, carrying a black cat in her arms. When she was offered the opportunity to be moved to another room, she said she'd rather stay, and that they were kindly ghosts, like good companions. Mary and the others send their love. Come and see us again some day before too long. Yours, Freddy." And that's the end of Casper, Prince of Cats. I hope you enjoyed it. Have a great summer.